Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Mpuga.
I think China has come in to save the deal for both Uganda and Tanzania. It's very important for both countries. But it's also shown within the multilateral international framework that the West is not the only game in town.
Uganda is in the final stages of negotiations with China for a loan to finance the construction of the East African crude oil pipeline.
I think it's high time African leaders, particularly those who have had troubles in their country like Uganda and who have overcome much of that, about time they look into this issue.
Uganda will mediate between Somalia and the breakaway region of Somaliland to facilitate a reunification.
We really happy that it has not gone through, just for the reason that this was going to be detrimental to the effort that or to the gains that conservation has done over the years.
And Southern African countries express relief after the UK's House of Lords rejected a ban on the import of wildlife trophies from Africa. Those and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Uganda is in the final stages of negotiations with Chinese lenders for a $3 billion loan to finance the construction of the East African crude oil pipeline, according to local media. Uganda's Minister of Energy and Mineral Development reportedly expects to finalize talks with the Chinese lenders by next month. The pipeline to transport crude oil from Uganda's Lake Albert oil fields to Tanzania's Indian Ocean coast has had financing issues as several major Western banks have pulled out of investing in the project due to pressure from environmental groups. Environmentalists accuse Uganda of going against the global push for energy transition away from fossil fuels. David Mwanda is a political analyst and professor of political science at the City University of New York. He tells me that although the pipeline is important to both Uganda and Tanzania, he's worried about what he calls the oil curse.
I think China has come in to save the deal for both Uganda and Tanzania. It's very important for both countries. But it's also shown within the multilateral international framework that the West is not the only game in town. That global South countries, developing countries, have alternate financiers, in this case, China. But the other challenge, I must say, is that with this alternate financing, there is this problem of debt diplomacy. How Uganda and Tanzania will get into further and further debt, this $3 billion that China's investing will have to be paid back. Now, with the weakness of both economies in East Africa, how will that money be raised? So those are very pressing and challenging issues that even though I think this pipeline is going forward, these are also major concerns for both countries in terms of debt repayment and Chinese debt diplomacy.
Debt aside, Western banks were under pressure not to finance this project because of environmental concerns. China doesn't care much about that. They care?
I think the Chinese will say they care about the environment. Uganda has consistently insisted that due diligence was followed in terms of assessing environmental impacts and any concerns have been mitigated. But I think the other broader question here is, especially given the recent Africa Climate Summit in Nairobi and the Nairobi Declaration, the idea that countries were going to wean themselves away from fossil fuels. But with this pipeline, we see countries, Tanzania and Uganda, going in the exact direct opposite direction, right? So they're reinvesting in this dirty fuel, carbon-based fuel, petrochemicals. So I think it creates its own problems. But I think more broadly, as you've mentioned, there is a big question about China's commitment to reducing climate change, reducing the increase in carbon emissions, because a lot of this oil, of course, I would believe would be going to China to fuel the Chinese economy, which is currently really struggling. So it also raises major questions about not only China's commitment to solving the climate crisis by reinvesting in fossil fuels in both these countries, Uganda and Tanzania, but also Uganda and Tanzania's commitment to climate change. I think that is also a very valid criticism of all these countries involved in this pipeline.
What would you say to those who assert that other countries, some of them developed countries, are still exploiting fossil fuels and making lots of money as their poor countries try to exploit the same resources, their concern, environmental concerns?
I think that's a big, big concern, especially as you've mentioned, in the context of China. China champions itself as being a leader of the developing South, a leader of developing countries, as not having been a colonial power in Africa. But the critics of China have really emphasized the idea that China is really replacing a lot of the imperialistic, extractive tendencies of European and American companies in the 19th and 20th century with its own form of neo-imperialism in some of these mega projects, particularly on fossil fuels in Africa. When we, particularly as you've mentioned, China may not be overly concerned about the environment, but China also has not been very keen about tying some of these projects to good governance and human rights. And there are a lot of critics of Chinese policy on the continent who might argue, for example, that funding some of these projects in countries like Uganda, which has a very challenging human rights record, which has a kleptocratic authoritarian who's been in power for many, many decades with very few democratic credentials, that China is actually reinforcing bad governance, authoritarianism on the continent by funding some of these projects. And even in the case of Tanzania, where the CCM, the ruling party, has also been accused of undemocratic governance, a lot of the proceeds from these projects, like this pipeline, will go to reinforce some of the structures of repression in both Tanzania and Uganda. Lastly, I must mention there is a danger that the extraction of these billions of barrels of oil in Uganda and their export actually leaves Uganda in a very delicate position with this idea of the fuel curse, the oil curse. So will Uganda go the way of many countries on the African continent that have had huge amounts of oil, but end up misusing that resource, and it actually ends up being a net negative to the country? So I'm thinking here of countries like Gabon, countries like Nigeria, which have huge, or Equatorial Guinea, huge oil reserves, but a lot of that money doesn't end up benefiting the population. I think that's a context for Uganda that's really important to think about. Exactly how will the authoritarian regime of Museveni, that's been in there for so many years, has been very unaccountable, has engaged in gross human rights violations and repression of democracy, how will this money then be used, these billions of dollars, how will they then be used to further the basic needs of Ugandans? Or will this money ultimately go into the pockets of a few individuals in the governments in Dar es Salaam or Dodoma for Tanzania's case, or Kampala for Uganda?
That's David Mwanda, a political analyst and professor of political science at the City University of New York. He spoke with me from New York.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis. Be sure to join us this weekend for highlights from the United Nations General Assembly and reaction to President Biden's meetings with Ukraine's President Zelensky and Israel's Prime Minister Netanyahu. Don't miss Issues in the News every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hundreds of demonstrators gathered in the Ghanaian capital Accra on Saturday for a third day of anti-government protest linked to economic hardship that has led dozens of arrests. Reuters reports protesters, some waving placards or the Ghanaian flag, decried the high cost of living and the lack of jobs as they marched under the watch of riot police. The gold, oil and cocoa producing nation has been battling its worst economic crisis in a generation, brought on by spiraling public debt. Reuters says police blocked the road to prevent protesters approaching Jubilee House, the seat of the presidency, which the group called Democracy Hub has vowed to occupy. On Thursday, police said 49 people had been detained for unlawful assembly and violating the Public Order Act on the first day of the three-day action. There was no sign of further arrests, and the situation appeared calm on Saturday. Last year, protests over soaring prices and other economic challenges led to clashes with the police. Uganda said on Saturday it would mediate between Somalia and the breakaway region of Somaliland to facilitate reunification after more than three decades split, Reuters reports. A statement from the presidency says President Yoweri Museveni of Uganda agreed to take up the role after a visit on Friday by a special envoy from Somaliland, Jama Musa Jama. Somaliland broke away from Somalia in 1991, but has not gained widespread international recognition for independence. It's been mostly peaceful, while Somalia has undergone civil war. Reunification would potentially strengthen the country's capability to tackle challenges, including an insurgency by the Islamist group Al-Shabaab. To find out more about the prospects of the reunification of Somalia, I reached Abdi Ismail Samata, a professor at the University of Minnesota and a senator in the Somali parliament.
No, I think it's high time African leaders, particularly those who have had troubles in their country like Uganda and who have overcome much of that, about time they look into this issue. Because by and large, the Somali people, whether they are in Somaliland or in the South, they have more in common than any other group of Africans anywhere in the world. And so it's the political class that have ruined the country, both in the North and in the South. And I think it's really appropriate that President Museveni takes this responsibility upon himself.
Yeah, as Museveni says, it would be a good thing and it would strengthen the Horn of Africa. In your opinion, is he the right person to mediate?
Well, I mean, President Museveni has two faces, in a sense, in his life. One is the warrior that got rid of Idi Amin with the help of the Tanzanians, but also subdued the wars, the northern warlords. And so he has that credibility in a sense unifying Uganda. Somalia doesn't need a war to unify both sides. I think it needs somebody who is incredibly wise, but who is also very seriously informed about the history of the country, and therefore President Museveni is going to need people behind the scenes who will advise him as to how to tackle this in order to be able to appeal straight to ordinary people in the South and in the North whose lives have been brutalized for almost 3.5 decades. So it's a wise step, but he will need help, and I'm not too sure he's wise enough to get that help.
Somalia has had a lot of conflicts and it's been in a mess. And Somaliland has been fairly peaceful. How do you envisage a unified Somalia?
Well, two things. You know, there has been trouble in the eastern part of Somaliland in the last 2 years. And there has been quite a lot of bloodshed, unfortunately, in the city of Las Anod and that neighborhood where secessionists within Somaliland themselves are fighting this war. And the regime in Hargeisa have not been wise enough to figure out a peaceful way to consolidate power in Hargeisa, but also in the provinces. The southern political class, in my opinion, has been the ultimate curse on the Somali people wherever they are. They are about themselves, and they don't care a bit about the brutality that has been visited on our people in that region of Somalia. And so President Museveni is the sort of a heavy-handed man who can possibly negotiate with those people. But one thing he said in my presence when there was the negotiation in the 2000, early years of the 2000s, in Eldoret and then later on in Nairobi, where ultimately the federal government was established. In that first meeting in Eldoret, while the other leaders from Kenya and Ethiopia and elsewhere were sort of sharing crocodile tears with the Somali warlords and others, President Museveni spoke bluntly to them, and he, at that point, I have that quote in my book. He said, "You are the shame of Africa. How dare you brutalize your own people for 20 years, people who have the same faith, people who have the same culture, people who have the same language. There is no place else in Africa to turn that jewel into hell. You are ultimately the shame of Africa," he said. And I think he was spot on then, and I think he's spot on today to be able to say, let's figure this one out.
what chances do you give it of going through?
I think if it's done properly, there is a reasonable chance. But if it's about, if it's only present Museveni and people who don't know Somalia, then the chances will be terrible, in my opinion.
That's Abidi Ismail Semata, a professor at the University of Minnesota and a senator in the Somali Parliament. He spoke with me from Minneapolis, Minnesota, here in the U.S. In Zambia, a traditional ruler is calling for reconciliation between President Hakainde Hichilema and former President Edgar Chagwa Lungu. Paramount Chief Nkosi Mpezini, the fourth king of the Ngoni people in the country's eastern province, expressed concern about what he says is the increasing tension between the two leaders. He warns it will breed divisions and undermine development efforts. His call is backed by other traditional leaders in the province, who are also calling on the two leaders to bury their differences and work together. Their remarks come after the local media reports Lungu was prevented from traveling to South Korea for a peace summit. He had previously been prevented from traveling to South Africa for his annual health review. For more reaction following the traditional leader's call, VOA's Peter Klote reached Ambassador Kanyamula Zulu. He is an advisor to the Paramount Chief and a former Zambian High Commissioner to Australia.
It is a very important call from a traditional leader, very senior traditional leader, who has been on the throne for more than 40 years. He served Kenneth Kaunda, he served Fred Chiluba, he served Mwanawasa, he served Lupia, he served everybody. Now he's serving President Mwanawasa. His call is very important because he has appealed to the former president to give chance to his colleague, because he was elected by the people of Zambia. So give chance and bring peace to Zambia. There is no time for arguments, quarreling. It's not politics at all. So it is a very important call.
How are Zambians reacting to this call so far?
Well, they have warmly received the call of the Paramount Chief. They have called others to do the same, to emulate him. Ask our presidents, our leaders, to forget the past and let us move on as one people, so that the enemy of Zambia is ashamed.
What do you say to those who are of the view that more traditional leaders should also make this call, because they are seeing that supposed tensions between the president and the former president appears to be soaring, and that if it is not resolved amicably, there could be politically related violence between supporters of the two gentlemen? Your reaction?
Yes, it is. I think they must call the nation to us. We are a peaceful people in Zambia, a very peaceful country indeed. We have never known violence. So the Paramount Chief of the Ngoni people of Eastern Province call has been welcomed, and it is being emulated by other traditional leaders. It was a honest, truth call for our leadership, our politics, to get to order, to reconcile each with each other. Everybody, from man to man, chief to chief, president to president, so that we can move on, let the president move this country forward. Elections come and go, he was elected by the people, so the Paramount Chief thinks that he needs to be given a chance to work, not to quarrel.
Looking forward, what are your expectations that the chief's call will be adhered to by the two camps of these two leaders, or, you know, two gentlemen of Zambia?
Well, I personally feel that the president-elect, HH, is doing a good job to reconcile the country, the whole country. to bring peace. All that he wants is peace. No body has been arrested for acting otherwise. So I think it is important that we heed the call by the paramount chief. And I think we are happy so far that the nation is hearing the voice of the paramount chief of the Ngoni people.
That's Ambassador Kanyamulu Zulu, an advisor to the paramount chief and a former Zambian High Commissioner to Australia. He spoke with VOA's Peter Klote. Southern African countries which allow trophy hunting are relieved after a bill which sought to ban the import of legally obtained wildlife trophies from Africa into the United Kingdom was blocked in the House of Lords last week. Bukundisi Dube reports from Botswana's capital, Gaborone.
The trophy hunting bill, championed by Conservatives, sailed through the House of Commons and appeared set to win approval in Britain's House of Lords. However, a group of peers successfully blocked the legislation, which would have banned the importation of wildlife trophies into the UK. UK-based conservation biologist Keith Lindsay says it is a shame the bill did not succeed.
It is a great injustice that unrelated peers in the British House of Lords can block the passage of legislation that was already approved by an overwhelming majority of elected MPs from all parts of the Commons and all parties.
Peers who opposed the bill argued the politicians failed to listen to conservation experts and ignored the science on trophy hunting. Lindsay disagrees, saying there are scientists opposed to trophy hunting.
There are, in fact, many biologists and conservationists who are concerned about the negative impacts of selective hunting on wildlife populations that are already under pressure from poaching and land use conversion. And there are many communities in all parts of Africa, other than a handful in southern Africa, who value their wildlife alive.
Five southern African countries, Botswana, South Africa, Namibia, Zambia, and Zimbabwe, released a statement Friday thanking the group of peers for blocking the proposed law. Botswana CEO Kasi Masiku, who is part of a committee of conservationists from southern African countries that traveled to the UK to lobby against the bill, was elated with the outcome.
We really happy that it has not gone through, just for the reason that this was going to be detrimental to the effort that or to the gains that conservation has done over the years. We believe on sustainable utilization of biodiversity within our communities, and our communities have actually, through generation to generation, protected the wildlife within their area. This is why we see growth within these areas in wildlife numbers.
Botswana has earned millions of dollars by allowing trophy hunters to shoot a limited number of elephants and other animals each year. Simasiku says if the bill won approval in Britain, other Western countries would likely follow suit.
If the bill has gone through, what we know is the UK is very influential. This was going to also maybe move to other countries which have ties with UK, and at the end of the day, our communities will be at a loss.
Despite the bill's failure, Britain's Labour Party is already leading calls to resurrect the legislation. Kondisi Dube, VOA News, Gaborone, Botswana.
This is Science in a Minute.
For years, scientists have been looking for the existence of life within the solar system beyond Earth. While there hasn't been any evidence of actual life elsewhere, there have been some scattered clues that some of the needed conditions for it do exist at a few locations in the solar system. Jupiter's moon, Europa, a fascinating world, has shown the most promise to possibly harbor life. The Jovian moon has a salty subsurface ocean of liquid water, possibly twice as much as in all of Earth's oceans combined. Astronomers using data gathered by the James Webb Space Telescope have found evidence of carbon, a key building block of life on Europa's surface. They say the element likely originated in the moon's subsurface ocean. NASA says this discovery shows a possibly habitable environment in the ocean of Europa. Rick Pantaleo, VOA News.
When an award-winning Sudanese filmmaker documented the journey of Sudan's martial arts team, which traveled by road to Kenya for an international championship in 2019, he did not know that 4 years later he would be taking a similar path as he did in the film Journey to Kenya, but for completely different reasons. VOA's Nairobi Bureau Chief Mariama Diallo recently attended the screening of his movie and those of other Sudanese filmmakers and has this story.
It's a journey the group thought would take 2 to 3 days from Sudan to Kenya via Ethiopia to participate in an international jiu-jitsu competition in Nairobi, but it turned out to be full of surprises. Award-winning Sudanese filmmaker Ibrahim Ahmad, also known as Snoopy, told VOA.
It took us 6 days, you know, days sleeping in the car, days sleeping at a gas station in the car. And I remember that there was a coup in Ethiopia. We had no internet and we couldn't follow the map, so we lost the road.
In this clip, team member Zuhair.
The hardest part for me was just sitting in the car there, like, you know, it was so long.
At the end, through insurmountable challenges at times, they made it to Nairobi 2 hours before the competition started. And they made their country proud. Screening the movie for the first time in Nairobi felt different, Snoopy told us. He recently had to make a similar trip again because of the war in Sudan over the past 5 months.
Right now, I'm living my movie, you know, not living with the characters like in before as a filmmaker. And I went through the same thing, you know. And it was so painful because I traveled for 18 hours from Ethiopia to Kenya borders and from Kenyan borders to here 19 hours.
Rafael Reynas, another filmmaker, also debuted a short documentary about an unusual beauty salon in Khartoum. The salon is also a sanctuary for women across Sudan fleeing domestic violence. In this clip, one victim tells her story.
I got married in 2017. The first 6 months, we were in a good place. After 6 months, my life turned 180 degrees. Then started the verbal abuse, hitting.
With this film, she's trying to help people understand what some women in Sudan go through.
The domestic violence, the harassment outside, the even the rape, there's a lot of stuff going on. So I'm just trying to, you know, tell the story in a creative way that's like, I'm not attacking the man. I'm just giving the woman space.
Last but not least, the audience got to enjoy the screening of another Sudanese filmmaker, Yasser Fayez. The award-winning 15-minute film is based on the novel The Waste Man. The actual title is considered a bit crude. It rhymes with dog sitter. The thought of the main character's daughter who turned 18 having a boyfriend brings up layers of her father's Sudanese culture he thought he had left behind when he emigrated to the Netherlands 26 years prior.
It's actually a film about immigrant facing problem of with the culture of the place he lived. He thinks that he have no problem, but when these critical events, the problems came out.
While these filmmakers have found a new place to live in Kenya, they also hope to someday be able to document the war at home in Sudan. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
Listening to Nightline Africa, and coming up in the second half of the program, sports. A commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, and music from our African collection. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's go to Abuja and join Samson O'Malley. Hello, Samson.
Hi, Douglas, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. We begin with athletics as Eliud Kipchoge of Kenya secured his fifth Berlin Marathon victory on Sunday in his first race since finishing sixth at April's Boston Marathon. 38-year-old double Olympic champion Kipchoge finished alone at the front in a time of 2 hours, 2 minutes, 42 seconds. Fellow Kenyan Vincent Kipkemboi was 31 seconds behind him in second, with Tadese Takele of Ethiopia a further 11 seconds back in third. Kipchoge was gracious in his victory in Berlin.
I've learned lessons. I have won, but I've not break a world record. So it's going back again. Every race is a learning lesson. And put all the experience in next year in Olympics in Paris and try to build a podium or to win for the third time ever and make history.
In the women's category, it was Ethiopia's Tigzit Ashifa who smashed the women's marathon world record as she won the Berlin Marathon. Ashifa, who also won last year's race, crossed the line in a time of 2 hours, 11 minutes and 53 seconds. The 29-year-old took more than 2 minutes off the previous record of 2 hours, 14 minutes, 04 seconds set by Kenya's Bridget Kosgei in Chicago in 2019. And now to rugby. The Rugby World Cup taking place in France featured one of the most anticipated matches on Saturday when South African national team, the Springboks, suffered a disappointing 13-8 defeat against the top-ranked team in the world, Ireland, in their Rugby World Cup Pool B clash at the Stade de France in Paris. With the Springboks having won their opening matches against Scotland and Romania, the match in Paris was not a do or die. However, it does mean they have to register a win against Tonga next week Sunday to advance to the quarterfinals. Springbok coach Jack Nianamba and captain Celia Kulisi ruled their missed opportunities in the match but said they will keep their heads high and turn their focus to next week's encounter against Tonga.
They were, hats off to Ireland, they were better than us on the day. And yes, I think we missed a couple of points off the tee. But I won't say that that's the reason solely for not getting across the line. I think we, in the first half alone, we lost two balls.
Yeah, I thought they were more accurate than us today, and they were a bit faster in the breakdown. But as Jack said, we knew it was coming. Obviously, we players, we take full responsibility of that.
Nigeria has been crowned champion of the 2023 ITTF Africa Para Championships, which ended on Saturday in Giza, Egypt. The three-day tournament had host Egypt, Algeria, Nigeria, Mauritius, Cameroon, South Africa, Kenya, and Ivory Coast competing in the singles, doubles, and mixed doubles events. Nigeria won 12 gold medals to dethrone Egypt as the new para table tennis champion in Africa, dominating in the singles event to pick up most of the tickets to the Paris 2024 Paralympic Games. And that's it for this week's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Douglas.
Thanks, Samson. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospects in time of conflict and in time of peace. Here is one man point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. This week, general debate in the General Assembly during the 78th session was open, and a great number of African states participated in the first week. The impression one gets is that the African delegations are fired up. They have been energized by recent developments, such as the successful BRICS summit held in South Africa and the decision by the Group of 20 held in Delhi at their summit to include the African Union as the 21st member. This is why the African speakers, as their colleagues in the Global South, were determined not to allow this session be dominated by the issue of Ukraine as they believed it was during the 77th session. Many of the African speakers did make reference to the Ukraine war and their impact on the economy of the African states, but they did not dwell on it. Recognizing their interest to solve the problem, President Ramaphosa, who spoke during the early session of this week's debate, made clear that the African states want negotiations to resolve the war. And he gave the example of the group of seven African leaders that intervened to promote negotiations, that what they are doing in their results. He noted that in his meeting with President Zelensky, he was told that the two proposals already made by the African leaders, the return of children and the issue of prisoner exchange, are beginning to work. The African states also wanted to emphasize two major issues for the Global South, and which is important to them. One, multilateralism. Secondly, the issue of the economy. Now, with regards to the multilateralism, African views were aligned with that of Secretary General Guterres, who made an opening address. In that address, the Secretary General noted correctly that there was a brief period after the Cold War that we have unipolarity, but that, he said, is gone. We now reimagine of multilateralism centered in the Charter of the United Nations. The Secretary General mentioned that multilateral institutions today are not working and are not solving problems. Yes, Africans agree with that. But their view is that the present structure of multilateral institutions do not support progress. For them, there is the lack of democracy within these institutions, and there are imbalances. And most of the time, African states, as well as many in the Global South, do not have much of a voice in how these institutions are run. What has been left out is a crucial aspect, because everyone mentioned reform of the Security Council. But the Security Council reform discussion, which began in 1996, continues with mere discussion and talk. President Ramaphosa, when he spoke to the assembly, said Africans are encouraged by the mounting support for Africans' views about the expansion of the Security Council. But he pointedly said that they want not just talk, but textual proposals instead of just promises by some permanent members to support Africans. So we will wait and see what will follow. I thank you.
That was one man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Girl, I wanna take you around the world. Yeah. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect with music from the continent. I wonder where you're coming from, my superwoman. I wonder which part of this world that you came from. You got a nice looking body, original woman. I wanna call you my lady, my classic. Tell me, what does it really take to know you, lady? How long does it really take to get close to you? My African baby, my beautiful baby, yeah. My African woman, you're my African baby, yeah. You're my African lady, yeah. I'm so in love with you, superwoman, woman. Girl, I'm in love with you, superwoman. Me nikaje na kudoni.
be your number one African girl, my beautiful lady, an African baby, my superwoman. Hey. It's your boy Chris Monta. You're my African baby. African lady, yo. I'm so in love with you. Superwoman, woman, girl, I'm in love with you. Superwoman, woman. Yeah. You got to trust me and trust me, baby, you're my one and only. Yeah.
easy. It could be, baby, baby, it's tough. Take it easy. Can you believe? I swear I can breathe. Me fine, darling, darling. If you touch me one more time, I might lose my mind. The view is too much here. Can we go slowly? Cause I can't take it.
this beat, DJ Rampage.
She shake a fever bingo. Watch me wait at the shoe. Gally title now you hola. Nobody no go take her. You sabi make it enough. Nothing no go cool and you go be me mort. You know me what I ought. You don't engage mistakes. You don't make a fool your god. Anytime I say I know they do tell me but search you mort. Just take a say na joke cause I can be naughty a lot. Baby stop. Now you bing bing. You sabi hold me limping. Talk naughty na me yes. Make me step in crispy days. Give you whisk and hear me. Make me fetch my medal.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English Service of the Voice of America. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English Service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoyed the program tonight. And as you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the Nightline Africa team. We thank you for joining us, and I'm your host, Douglas Impoga in Washington, wishing you a very good evening.